You need to make a decision, but don't want to make a mistake. For decades, Dr. Constance Derricks has helped leaders make wise decisions. Now, she's sharing how to see what others don't and make great decisions when it matters most. So come on in and have a seat. It's time for your appointment with the Decision Doctor.
Hi, I'm Constance Derricks, and welcome to my podcast. I am thrilled to share with you my conversation with Michael Bungay Stanier. MBS, as he's known, was recently awarded the Thinkers 50 Marshall Goldsmith Award for coaching and mentoring. MBS is a delightful amalgam of profound intellect, animated curiosity, and a lovely sense of humor. His most recent book is How to Get Along with Almost Anyone. Now, for those of you that may get a little bit squirmy hearing that, you will be very relieved to know that he acknowledges some relationships will never be more than polite. An earlier book, one I also love, is The Advice Trap. His pragmatism, cut to the chase style, and nearly unerring way of knowing the right chase to cut to is on full display in his TED Talk, How to Tame Your Advice Monster. It is poignant, funny, and best of all, wise. Hello, Michael. I am so excited to see you on the screen and to have you join my podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. We've had this in the books for a while, so it's nice to get here and hit record and you and me have a great conversation.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And a conversation is always so fun, especially with you, because I find your writing to be such a delicious combination of nuance and pragmatism that you do not sacrifice nuance on the altar of pragmatism.
that's a nice compliment. Thank you.
Yeah,
I do have a broad philosophy. It comes from a quote, which is like trying to find simplicity on the other side of complexity. So taking kind of tricky and slightly obscure and slightly theoretical things like coaching or like psychological safety and going, how do I make this feel doable to a normal person? And so that's my goal for sure.
Yes, yes. Well, you do it so well. And in the simplifying, though, you don't fall victim to or lead your reader or listener to oversimplify and falsely dichotomize, which, you know, is the enemy of synthesis,
right?
Which is a favorite concept. So I noticed in one of your books, you had some opposites that you recommended that the reader look at. I think it's in your latest book, which is How to Get Along with Almost Anyone. And the almost on the title page looks like, oh, I guess I should put almost in there.
Right.
Not to be too bold, but I love that you encourage the listener to be a little bit more nuanced in that. And I suspect
we are messy, interesting, complicated, confusing, contradictory people. So I'm a bit allergic to the gurus who are like seven steps to the thing. And like, it's, I don't know about you, but it's never seven steps for me. It's more 107, and half of them are going backwards and some are going sideways. And there's a couple of big leaps and the universe is chaotic. We are chaotic. So we have this hunger for simplification, and that can be really powerful. But if you take it too far, you just get something that is a bland, not very useful truism.
Yeah, yeah, bromides. And I suspect that this thinking, which you express so well in writing, is one of the underlying factors in you receiving a recent award from Thinkers 50, Marshall Goldsmith, the Coaching and Mentoring Award. And for the listener who may not know about Thinkers 50 or may have missed Marshall Goldsmith, who would those people be? This is a very big deal. And you have many colleagues in MG100, myself included, who are just delighted for you. And
you.
I'm interested, what does it feel like to be so honored?
You know, it, this is the third time the award has been awarded, and I've been on the shortlist all three times.
Yes.
And I wasn't expecting to be on the shortlist this time. So I was quite surprised to get put on. I was like, I think they're not just putting me on to make me feel good about myself. I wasn't really expecting to win. You know, in the 10 minutes leading up to the award, I was like, you know, I would actually quite like to win more than I thought I would. It feels, I'm not sure how it feels, Constance. You know, I am much more interested in the impact of the work, my work, that I don't really know about. You know, the language I use to talk about the goals I have for myself, or the big goal, is to infect 1 billion people with the possibility virus. I came up with that 20 years ago, before we had COVID, when it was when having an impossibility virus felt as a useful metaphor rather than some weird pandemic metaphor. Mm-hmm. But the idea is to encourage people to have the courage and confidence to make the braver choice. That's what, for me, what the possibility virus mm-hmm. is about. But the metaphor of a virus works because it, let's say, decenters me as like the guru, the person. Mm-hmm. And it's about, how do I get ideas out in the world so that they spread? There is a part of me that loves the spotlight and getting an award. And I was really chuffed to be recognized. But it doesn't change a lot in terms of how I think about myself or how I think about the work, which is, you know, this is lovely. But some people know Thinkers 50, most people don't. So, you know, mm-hmm. this doesn't change much really in the big scheme of things, mm-hmm. other than the pleasure in having a number of individuals like you and others, you know, congratulating me and saying mm-hmm. it's well deserved. That feels a very nice recognition.
And hopefully affirmation that you're this virus, this of possibility, of courage. Another word I associate strongly with you is curiosity. Mm. That is taking root. And for people to embed some of your language, your ideas, and your insights into their everyday work, I think is a wonderful contribution.
It's amazing. And that is amazing. That's what really amazes me, when people are saying, oh yeah, we use this, or my man. I got this email from somebody the other day saying, oh, I saw you on a plane. I didn't want to say hello because you look busy and I don't know you. But just so that you know, my manager uses the coaching habit stuff all the time and he's a much better manager for it. You know, that's just a random comment, and they show up not infrequently. And that feels lots of places where I'm making a very small contribution to make things a bit better.
But maybe it isn't small. If a manager gets better by 20%, and you think about how many people they're managing,
right,
and more importantly, what sort of managing that person is modeling for the next generation.
Yeah.
You know, that's how, you know, if you were my client, which you are not, I think it's important for people to understand the effect, you know, the ripple effect of what they're doing and what they offer and put out there. One other thing that I enjoy a lot about your writing and how you show up as a person, your physicality, your clothing, is you encourage people to be bold. And I think there's a quote that you have on one of your websites, and it's from a movie that I have watched about 20 times, Strictly Ballroom.
Oh, see, I knew I liked you. That's like one of the all-time great movies as far as I'm concerned. Yeah,
I know. And why don't more people know about this? It's profound. But the quote is, a life lived in fear is a life half lived. You encourage people to, you know, when the spotlight is on you, be in it fully. You know, show up, be bold. And I love that. So how do you help people do that? You're modeling it yourself, at least the few times that I've been in the same room with you. But how do you help people show up as their very best self and be proud of that?
I'm not sure. So I hear from people that how I show up and kind of role model that is helpful for people. So that's part of it. You know, if you look at some of the deeper currents to the work I've written about and try and teach, there's probably two two kind of core themes that show up. One is kind of more fully seeing and hearing another person. I often quote Martin Buber and his I-it, I-thou relationships. And
oh, yes.
In many ways, you know, the coaching books and also the How to Work with Almost Anyone, it's about how do you build working relationships that feel more human so you get to see each other more completely. And I think there is a way that when you feel seen more fully, you encourage to be that full version of yourself. So perhaps that. And then a book I wrote a year and a half ago called How to Begin, which is about how do you find a worthy goal, a goal that's thrilling and important and daunting. You know, the key line in that book is we unlock our greatness by working on hard stuff. And so encouraging people to be a bold version of themselves, I'm not sure it works as a direct challenge. Constance, I need you to be a bigger, bolder version of you. You're like, oh, I don't know, it feels a heavy burden. But if you find something to work on that lights you up and contributes to the world and stretches you, then a commitment to doing that work feels like a commitment to showing up in a bigger version. And so it's a little bit like coming at happiness. You kind of have to come at it sideways to find it, I suspect.
Yes. And it reminds me of whether or not you're trying to directly impact something or whether you're creating an environment in which that thing is more likely to happen. My clients will ask me not infrequently things like, well, how do I motivate people? And how do I, you know, and you're right. There's not a checklist. There's not like, well, if you do these three things, then magic will happen and everyone will be motivated and they'll be working their butts off.
If one of the things is continuing to show up and in small ways, cajole, encourage and hold space and create standards. I mean, it's all of it's simple and difficult. And part of the difficulty is, it often happens through ongoing small things rather than one large intervention that changes everything.
Yes. Or through a company-wide training.
Yeah. I have a company that does company-wide trainings, but with the clients where that works, there's more to it than just put people through a one-day training session. There's lead up, there's support, there's engagement of the system around it to help people shift their behavior.
Right. So we're back to environment. Where you can offer people education and you can give them some practice. But if that falls on infertile soil, then, you're
There's
right.
There's a great quote by Winston Churchill, which I'll get slightly wrong, but it's something like we shape our buildings and thereafter they shape us.
It's one of my favorites. How did you know? Yes.
Well,
yes.
It speaks profoundly to how much our behavior is influenced by our environment. You know, that metaphor that often gets talked about in the change world is around the rider and the elephant on the path. This being a metaphor for the levers of change, the rider being the rational case, the elephant being the emotional kind of case, and the path being the environment. And we put most of our emphasis on the rider, keep thinking if we just convince people with the facts that will change them. But the rider actually doesn't have a whole lot of influence. What really influences is the path and also the training the elephant's got growing up. That's what keeps it on the path. But people worry a lot less about the path and they should worry a bit more.
Yes. And the path is often not obvious to them.
Right.
You know, I often will have clients talk to me about their culture, their company culture, and they describe it to me and then we study it. And guess what? The results of the actual, you know, going out and investigating it don't match. They overlap. They always overlap. You know, my clients are smart people, so they definitely can describe their company. But then there's always those differences. And these habits, you know, you've written about habits as well. Yeah. And what there's another quote. You have so many great, I have this long list of things you've said or that you've quoted other people, but one of them was about how did you learn your work habits?
So that's an exercise from the new book. and it comes from Salesforce. It's one of the questions that they ask. And it's like, where did you learn your work habits from? And what's interesting about that, part of why people find it hard to articulate their culture, is that a culture is basically the way we do things around here.
Yes.
And most of the things we do them unconsciously. You know, there's research that says about 40, 45, 50% of what you do is done instinctively, habitually. And when you realize that a habit is an unconscious action and that half of what you do is unconscious, which means that pretty much half of how you understand or half of what a culture is an unconscious expression of behavior. That's why people find it hard to name a culture. I mean, mm-hmm. Ed Schein has a model where he says, look, a culture has three levels. You've got your artifacts, the stuff you can see.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your espoused values, the stuff you talk about. And then you've got your unconscious assumptions, which is your habits or your behaviors. And he says, look, most of the time when you ask people about culture, they talk about the first two things because they're obvious. But actually, the under the water iceberg is the behaviors. And then actually, until you have the three of those three things aligned, you don't really have a strong culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what I find interesting about culture also is when you are looking at artifacts. So you look at how an office is organized physically, the physicality, like who sits where and who's got the corner and all of that kind of stuff.
I mean, I'm looking at you and I'm like, okay, so Constance, a chic black turtleneck, professional glasses, books behind her. I mean, you're sending a whole bunch of things to me that say this is what it looks like. You're looking at me and you're like, it's disheveled. It's got an interesting background. You've got an ugly mustache. It must be Movember. You know, you're making up a bunch of stuff about me as well. And how quickly we make decisions about what all of that means. That's part of the artifacts.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And the choices that we make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you were talking about my bookshelves that I had put in here.
Nice.
And at one point in time, that was a decision that was conscious. But then it just becomes part of the landscape and it makes it so hard. But yes, we do. And we have to at a certain level. There's so much coming at us. There's so much information, people, things in our inbox, phone ringing, all of that, that we have to categorize, simplify. But what I find gets us in trouble is we make meaning out of those things, those decisions. We reify them.
Yeah.
And if you try to change them, for me, I will, first of all, I have a physiological response that I'll then label as, you know, who's this guy trying to tell me that, you know, my bookcase is all wrong or your background actually, I would describe it as very interesting. I mean, it's got all these different colors and pieces and it makes me want to ask you how you chose it.
Yeah, exactly. And would you like me to answer that or is that a theoretical question?
Yeah, no, if you're willing, I'd love to.
Part of it is I said to myself, look, lots of people have a nicely curated bookshelf behind them in this pandemic Zoom world. I was like, I'm in a small little office and I don't really, and my bookshelves are not, they're messy rather than laid out. This isn't new, but you know, some people have performative bookshelves. It's like, look at these books that tell you just how amazing I am.
Yeah.
This looks like a wall. In fact, it's a photo of a wall. This is a fabric screen that is on a frame that hangs on a tripod that covers up my thing. So I was like, okay, so I want an interesting background. I wanted it to be yellow because yellow is kind of the main color of my brand.
Yes.
And I wanted it to have texture and be interesting because I'm drawn to texture. And so I just went on to Shutterstock and searched around and found a picture of this wall and went, great, I'll pay $20 for that photo and uploaded it and got it printed on fabric.
That's great. That's great. And the way you described what you wanted is so reflective of the way you write. Mm. You know, it's got texture. It's got nuance. It's not typical, but it's also not so strange that I've spent the whole time trying to figure out what that is behind you. It just looks like, It looks like you bought a structure and you're renovating or something.
Right,
like
right.
that. Yeah.
And also, I'm also trying to figure out what I don't want. So that for me is a key part of this decision making. Something I'm really kind of exploring a bit at the moment, which is,
yeah,
so often decision making is not what am I going to say yes to, but what am I going to say no to? So often, if you can just get clear on what you're saying no to, the rest of it becomes pretty obvious. But we're wired to spend most of our time worrying about or thinking about what do I need to say yes to? Whereas it was like, okay, what do I not want? And when I figure out what I don't want, then that makes it clearer what I might want.
And that's analogous to strategy.
Exactly.
I mean, I was on a call last week with someone who told me that their strategic plan, by the way, I'm allergic to that phrase, strategic plan. What's your strategy? Tell me what your strategy is. The planning is, you know, comes after.
Yeah.
But he said that in that strategic plan, there were, you want to guess how many initiatives?
Well, I guess there's probably more than three.
Yes. 67.
That's ridiculous.
I thought, well, excuse me, I now need to go bang my head on this brick wall over here.
That's just silly.
It's right. It's more of an operating plan or something like that.
Yeah.
But that is a strategy that got weighted down by an inability to say no.
Right.
You know, I think Porter talked, was it Porter who talked about that strategy is so much about what we're not going to do?
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, I mean, the key question in strategy is what are we saying no to?
Yeah.
It's relatively easy to say no to all the stuff that's a clear no, but there's all this stuff, which is like, it'd be lovely to say yes to this. But I think strategy is really saying no to all the juicy stuff we kind of want to say yes to.
All the juicy stuff. Yeah. So,
and I know this because I am very much a shiny object person. So I'm always having ideas. I'm always like, oh, this would be amazing. And luckily I've got people around me who are better in practice, who are able to execute in practice what I talk about in theory, which is it's all about what we say no to. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that leads me to ask about the decisions you made early on when you were starting your company and running your company. First of all, how did you come to be in the business that you're in? And then how did you shape that business? What decisions did you make?
Well, I grew up in a family who all worked for the government in Australia. My mom and dad did, my two brothers do, their spouses do.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't have any immediate role models to start a business and become an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And I left Australia, studied in England, worked in England, moved to the States, worked in Boston for a while. And then in 2001, I flew from Boston to Toronto and moved to Toronto. So I've been here a couple of years, 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the job I had landed on in Toronto didn't go well. I was trying to help them with some internal brand culture stuff, and whatever it was I was suggesting wasn't what they wanted to be doing. So after 6 months or so there, they fired me. But luckily they fired me on pretty much the day my so-called maple leaf card arrived, which is the equivalent of a US green card.
Mm-hmm.
So I could work for people other than them. So that was great. And it just was becoming increasingly obvious that I was mostly unemployable. You know, I'm just not that good at having bosses. So I incorporated a company and got a job half-time creating models and intellectual property for a market research company, because in my past I'd done some market research. So I knew a bit about brands. I knew a bit about focus groups and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And meantime, started in a brand new city, so I didn't know anybody at all, trying to build a business. And so for the first year or two, my business model was find somebody with a wallet and see if they would give me some of their money. I had a range of skills. I knew about innovation. I knew about facilitation. I knew about market research.
Yeah.
I knew about a little bit about strategy. I had a grab bag of stuff. But in year three or four, I got a job designing a coaching program for a company. Yeah. This coincided with me doing my own coach skills training, starting a coaching practice, and then pretty quickly disbanding it because it turned out I didn't love coaching people. I mean, I like coaching people. I just don't like it being the main thing I do all the time with people. So when I first did this coach design, I designed a 2-day training program. Well, that was the start of me going, oh, there's something interesting here. You know, there's something that I have a point of view on, because I thought most coach training in organizations was pretty terrible. I thought there was a market need for it because people were beginning to train their people. And I thought I could earn some money doing it. So over the next 15 years, that company called Box of Crayons increasingly specialized in, we do coach skill training. And even now it's talking about curiosity in organizations and coach-like training for their people. And, you know, that all kind of blew up, in particular 7 or 8 years ago now, when I wrote the Coaching Habit book. And that really kind of became the big bestseller. That's how most people know me. And so Constance, I kind of stumbled into it, mostly necessity being the mother of invention and all of that, but also made some good decisions to kind of focus. You know, that Jim Collins metaphor, he says strategy is firing bullets and firing cannonballs. You know, you fire bullets to figure out which of your hypotheses is the real target. But once you find the target, you load up cannonballs and you fire cannonballs. And Collins says, you know, the problem mostly is that people either fire their cannonball too soon before they know what the real target is, or they never pluck up the nerve to fire the cannonball at all. And I think, you know, they're like, oh, this is the target, but maybe we'll just keep shooting, you know, bullets rather than cannonballs. So I think part of it was, in retrospect, more than deliberately doing it at the time, the process of me going, okay, there's a bunch of things I can do, firing away, trying to figure out. And once I landed on that one thing, I'm going, here's the thing we want to commit to.
Well, the coaching habit, you're right. It's so associated with you. And just for the listener, tell us what prompted you to write that book. And what, I guess what I'm curious about is, what did you notice that people that needed to coach others needed the most help with?
Well, The Coaching Habit was my third or fourth book. I'd had a book called Do More Great Work, which I'd first self-published and as called Find Your Great Work. And then a New York publisher called Workman bought it. It was exciting. And so they published it. It's like, oh, I've got a New York publisher. It's all very glamorous. And then some years later, I had this idea for The Coaching Habit, based in part because I'd been doing all this training. So I kind of had a point of view and I had some tools that I knew worked. And I kept trying to write the book that they wanted me to write, and they just never liked anything that I wrote for them. So eventually after like my sixth or seventh iteration, I figured I'd call their bluff. And I went, this is it, this idea or nothing. And they went, well, we're not interested. So I was like, oh, that's a bummer. So I felt a bit sorry for myself for a while, but then decided to self-publish The Coaching Habit, because I thought it solved a real problem, which is to unweird coaching for busy managers and leaders. That's who I was writing it for. You know, I knew lots of people were being asked to coach or be more coach-like.
Yes.
I knew lots of people were like, it's a touchy-feely, airy-fairy, woo-woo thing. I'm not
therapy.
A coach. I don't want to be a coach.
Yeah.
And I'm like, great. I don't want you to be a coach, and I don't want you to think of this as therapy or anything else. I think it's a leadership skill. Let me teach it to you as a practical leadership skill.
Absolutely. And I find that when people in organizations, I work mostly with CEOs and boards, but they will often say to me, you know, I really need to spend some time coaching this person.
Right.
You know, how do I do that? And what they're asking me for is, you know, the tactical one, two, three. And then I ask them, I say, well, what does that person want to achieve? What is driving them?
Right.
And what do you suspect I get back? I'm sure you know.
I have no idea.
Oh, yes, you do. They don't know.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I meant. When you're asking them,
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
I don't know what they want.
All I know
is what I want, which is for them to do this. And I'm going to call it coaching because it sounds a bit better than me just directing them to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You got in the role really fast. That's really good. Yeah, they don't know. And that takes me back to your evergreen advice about, you know, you show up, you're curious, you find out about the person, you form a relationship. And we know the power of that. And yet somehow it seems to people, tell me if you have this experience, seems to people like it costs too much time, like there's too much of an investment.
Mm-hmm. You know, the reason I wrote The Coaching Habit in part was to try and blow through this idea that coaching is therapy. In other words, it requires half an hour or an hour lying down on a couch going, oh, I know, isn't that terrible? And you know, part of the philosophy I would have is like, if you can't coach in 10 minutes or less, you don't have time to coach. So when you redefine coaching as the act of staying curious a little bit longer, mm-hmm. and when you understand that coaching or being more coach-like, which is the kind of the language I use to try and avoid saying, you're not a coach, you're just being more coach-like, you're just staying curious a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can do that in any interaction with somebody. In person, mm-hmm. over video call, on chat, on Slack. You know, when somebody writes you a thing on Slack, you can always just say, I get it, but what's the real challenge here for you? And send it through to them. And that's a coaching moment, you know, because you're asking a question. People do worry about the time, but if you can have them experience this way of getting to the heart of an issue really quickly, so they go, oh, actually, that was amazing. Now I get it. They start to see that a small investment up front means that they don't come back to you and come back to you and come back to you, or you haven't solved the wrong problem, which happens a lot. You're actually spending time to figure out what the real challenge is and solve that.
And you get at what the real problem is, or what the real stuckedness. I just see people stuck a lot in my work, but what will happen is they'll come back with the same problem, but it will be in a slightly different costume. Yeah. And so it can be, if you're not paying close attention, you can be distracted by that. And you can think, oh, you know, now I have to help them with this thing.
It changes your role radically when you decide that your job is just to figure out what the real problem is, not to be the person who needs to have an answer. And giving people permission to say, you don't need the answer, you're just going to help everybody around you figure out what the real problem is. Hey, that's more valuable and rarer. So you actually become a more valuable person in that team or in that organization. But once you know what the real problem are, it's generally relatively straightforward to find the answers to that. What's tricky is when you're trying to solve something that you're not sure it's actually the real thing to solve.
Or it's not the problem, but you've convinced yourself that it is, and you marshal all these resources and you get people really angry, and you get angry and irritable, and you know, off you go.
I agree.
The curiosity, the paying attention, the taking a moment to find out what's really going mm-hmm. on strikes me as being so much a part of your latest book about how to get along with almost anyone. And I was so relieved in the title to see the word almost, because I thought...
In all good conscience, I can't ever claim to know how to work with anyone. I'm like, you know, I've got my share of, more than my share probably, of screwed up working relationships. But I do reckon, and I think everybody's got one or two people in their lives who are like, yeah, that person never, but that leaves everybody else. So I'm like, if you can think of most of your key working relationships and understand that you can more actively shape them and improve them, that becomes better for you and better for them and better for the two of you and better for the work that needs to be done.
I wonder how many working relationships that are significantly subpar, just not great. Just go on and on and on like that because people don't have the awareness or don't make the decision to actually put some energy and intelligence into improving that relationship, starting with reading your book and learning about the Keystone conversation and all the great advice that's contained in that book. But before anybody can benefit, they have to really say, oh, yeah, this is something it's worth trying to improve. I'm going to invest some energy in it. We're back to that. Am I going to make the effort to make this better sort of problem?
And, I mean, I think it's a very legitimate choice sometimes to say it's not worth the effort. You know, it's too hard. There's too much of a power disparity. There's too much, there's too much water under the bridge. My job in this working relationship is just to survive it with minimum collateral damage. Yeah. I'm like, that's perfectly adequate. But, you know, John Gottman, a writer on relationships, says that 70% of all issues in a relationship are perpetual. You know, they don't actually change. I find this a very optimistic number because it means that, A, I can stop trying to solve the 70%. And B, it means that actually it might be as much as 30% in a working relationship that we could actually tinker with and co-create and improve. If you think about those hardworking relationships you have right now and you think to yourself, what if I could make that 30% better? I do think for many of us, that moves it from unbearable to bearable, from unworkable to workable. So the idea of the book is to have, you know, the thought is you're trying to build the best possible relationship with somebody. So a BPR, every working relationship has some potential to it. So you're trying to find the best expression of that particular working relationship. And that doesn't mean it's going to always be great. You're just trying to make it as good as possible. Mm-hmm. And the key idea is have a keystone conversation, a conversation about how you work together before you jump into the work itself. People say that this feels like a bit of an awkward conversation. And I'm like, it is.
It is an
awkward conversation.
Yes.
You're right. In part because it's rare. In part because both of you are being vulnerable to some extent when you say to the other person, hey, before we crack on with this work, how do we want to work together? You know, how do we play to our strengths? How do we avoid the hiccups and avoid our weaknesses? You know, what do we need to do? What do we need to know about each other so that we can work well together? Mm-hmm. And, you know, an invitation to say, let me tell you about me, you tell me about you, is like a bit vulnerable and a bit awkward. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if there's a call to action, when I teach this, it's like, be the person who reaches out and starts the conversation and is brave enough to suggest it, because that in itself is a gift for people.
Yeah, it is. And if you get rejected, scoffed at, that's information.
That is information. And I mean, I wish I could guarantee that every one of these conversations works, but they don't. Right. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. I think more often they do work. So, you know, when you're weighing up risk and reward, prizes and punishments, mostly the prizes outweigh the punishments when you're seeking to have a crack at this.
I think often people respond to the invitation, even if they're initially taken aback and thinking, what is this? Are we doing group therapy here? What's up with that? I mean, that's one I get a lot because of my background. Yeah. But, you know, when you said that about Gottman, I've actually been able to see John and his wife, Julie, speak as I'm sometimes off on these jaunts to get my continuing education credits, you know, and I love their work, but the mm-hmm. perpetualness of these issues is both comforting and frightening, I think, to a lot of people. But also what I like about it is they're so predictable. Yeah. And if we all think back to, when I was a resident, I did marriage therapy, and most of my clients, one or both parties, were physicians. So they were very smart people. And my supervising psychologist taught me to get the couple to talk about how they initially met and what initially attracted them to each other.
Right.
Because that tells you what the problem is.
Right.
It's always the underbelly of the thing that attracts us. You know, one anesthesiology resident said, "Oh, my wife was the life of the party. She's so vivacious." Well, what's the problem?
Yeah, she's the life of the party.
She can't settle down. She's not calm, you know, but what drew him to her. And of course, I had the joy of meeting her, and she was vivacious. She was energetic, but not unduly so. And what drew her to him? The opposite.
Yeah, exactly. Just calm, steady. No, he's like, he's so boring. Exactly.
And so when we hire people, it's kind of a similar thing. You know, you say, oh, well, this person, you know, blah, 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 whatever, fill in the blank. And then later, what do you want them to do? You want them to expand beyond that. You want them to do things differently. So your method of inviting people into this conversation, I think, can be so, it can be done in such a non-judgmental way.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, I think managers sometimes just get in the habit of criticism, you know, and just being critical. I was curious to know from you, because you have such great experience and longevity in doing what you do, and the human centeredness.
Just saying, I'm old. I keep it fine.
You're not as old as I am. So there,
longevity and experience. Like I get the subtext, but carry on.
I meant it as a total positive, because that breadth of experience shows up so much as you you have a lot of anecdotes to share, but more importantly, I think it's the insights that you've accumulated over time. But you've probably heard a lot of advice that other people have given your clients. And I'm curious, what's some of the worst advice that people are given when they're trying to become a better, not a coach, but what did you say? Engage in more coaching behaviors.
Be more like coach-like. Be more coach-like.
Be more coach-like. Yeah. What's some of the worst advice?
I think where it gets complicated for some people is going, okay, I need to be a coach, but nobody's told me what that is exactly. People feel like it's actually doubling down on telling people what to do. Because one of the role models for coaching is a sports coach, where you're like, I'm just going to lay down the law and be really clear about it, and now I'm coaching you.
I'll get louder.
So I think that's kind of the deeper thing, which is like just a fundamental misunderstanding about what coaching is. And that's why I define it as this idea of, can you stay curious a little bit longer? And then there are just sort of small tactical things, which is I encourage people not to ask or lead with questions that start with the word why.
Yeah.
Because I think it's quite hard to ask that question in a way that doesn't come across as a bit judgmental and a bit kind of, I'm just seeking more information so I can give you more better advice. But then also just, this is just probably personal preference, Constance, but you know, the way some people are taught active listening, where, you know, somebody will say something and the person who's coaching goes, I now have to repeat all of that back to you to prove that I was listening. And you're kind of doing it to prove that you're a good listener rather than being in service of another person. So, you know, when somebody's saying a lot of stuff to me, I'll often go, wow, it sounds like there's a lot going on there and it sounds like it's quite hard. And that's the proof I've listened to them in that little phrase, rather than going, well, you talked about your mother and it sounds like your car is broken down and the dog's unhappy and the garden isn't doing well and the parrot's sick and whatever else. I guess I'd just say that I think being coach-like, staying curious a little bit longer, is just simple and difficult. You know, it's simple to say, people get it immediately. I think we underestimate how much we have to unlearn to stay curious, because we are so trained and so wired to see the value that we bring as how fast can we come up with an answer or a solution or an opinion or a point of view.
Can I get a gee whiz reaction from the other person?
Right. Yeah.
Which is really being focused on yourself and how you're perceived rather than.
Sometimes I think people are just generally going, this is the best way I know how to help. I'm really keen to help you. And all I am aware of is, if you come to me with something, my job is to solve it for you. And so it takes quite a deep unlearning to go, sometimes your job, even if you have the best answer, sometimes your job is not to share the best answer, but to help them figure some stuff out themselves. If your job is to have them leave the conversation with a better sense of what's going on, with some better ideas, with a greater confidence, with greater insight, and you realize that being too quick with your own advice and opinions doesn't win the game.
I think there's something in there about advice being a trap, perhaps. another of your books, which I find, I just love that. I absolutely love that. And once you have it in your head that how often people leap to advice, you just start to see it everywhere. And
it is amazing. Yeah.
See it in yourself, or for myself, to see it in myself. Someone says, oh, this isn't going well. Well, have you thought about this? Have you?
Yeah, me too.
You know, it's like, wow.
It's even more annoying when you're the person who's written this book about not giving advice and you find yourself giving bad advice. You're like, this is not a good look.
Yeah, my mentor, Alan Weiss, has a saying. He says, unsolicited advice is for the benefit of the sender.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. Yeah.
I think there is, too. I did want to share with you a quote from Virginia Satir, who was a psychotherapist. She says, the only honest answer to a question that begins with why is I'm guilty.
That's it. I think it's very hard to ask a why question, which doesn't sound like an accusation. Why did you do this? Which might have a really genuine piece around it, which is like, I'm really curious as to what were the drivers that made this decision feel the best decision. It actually sounds like, well, why the hell did you do that?
Exactly.
Yeah. So at best, you're going to get a defensive reaction. Sometimes it's like, yeah. Like, I give up. Yeah, arrest me. I did it. Yeah.
Get the cuffs out.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I know. So one of the things that you advise people to do resonates so much with me from my training as a clinician, that we call it the hand on the door phenomenon. Mm. You've been sitting with someone for 48 minutes of your hour. You need 2 minutes to get them out the door. You get all the way to the door, their hands on the door, and they say, by the way. And then they drop a bomb on you. Yeah. But the way you are using this advice, it's different, where you say, is there anything else?
Yeah.
Anything else? And I think that if the listener of this podcast takes that away and uses it so that you reopen you crack the door again so that it doesn't feel like you, the manager, have decided that the meeting is over. You're inviting. I think it's just a brilliant, how did you come up with that?
I often use that question in the context of asking, and what else? Mm-hmm. And I just remember being taught that myself and just realizing the power that had. What it does is it's often not even really heard by the other person. What you're doing is you're just holding the space open longer for curiosity. So, you know, ask a question, you know, what's the real challenge here for you? What else? And what else? And what else? And then, is there anything else? Says, should I shut the door or should I keep it open? So it's an opportunity to move the conversation on if the energy is waning, but it's also a chance to say, do you want to sneak anything else in? And then the related question to this, I think, is perhaps, and this comes from the How to Work with Almost Anyone book, which is, as a kind of wrap up, is there anything that needs to be said that hasn't yet been said? And that has a similar thing, which is an invitation for somebody to say, oh, is there anything you've been sitting on or just haven't found the right way in, or feels a bit tender or a bit unformed? Is there anything you want to say about that? Mm-hmm. And I find that can be a really powerful question to uncover something that kind of has a real kind of significance to it.
So it's very tempting, Michael, to say, is there anything else to you as we wrap up our time together?
Our work might be done.
Our work might be done. Yes. Thank you so much. It's a joy to see you. And congratulations again on your marvelous award and for sharing your deep wisdom with the audience of the Decision Doctor podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Constance.
The Decision Doctor will be back with more advice soon. Hit the follow button on your favorite podcast app and check out thedecisiondoctor.com to receive the Meta Leadership Self-Assessment and other no-cost resources. We'll see you next time.
This has been a production of Twin Flame Studios.